So, hello, KXSU listeners and readers. I'm Kira Lochnan, the Digital Media Director over at KXSU.
Hi, this is Shasti Conrad. I am a Seattle U alum from 2007. I studied sociology and international studies, and I just received last night Seattle University's Most Outstanding Recent Alumni Award.
Congratulations for that.
Thank you.
Exciting. So today we just thought we'd sit down and talk a little bit about kind of your career and what you've done since graduating SU and kind of any messages or wisdom that you want to give back to current SU students, things like that.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, can you maybe talk a little bit about your background in terms of your career and, you know, what you studied at SU and things like that?
Sure. Yes. I grew up in Oregon. I was adopted from India as an infant by a single mom, and then we ended up in Oregon, and I went to high school in Oregon, a small town, and when I was a senior in high school, I received a postcard in the mail from Seattle University inviting me to apply for the Sullivan Leadership Scholarship. And so on a whim, not knowing really anything, I decided to put in my application, and I won the scholarship. And so that brought me up to Seattle University. And I was a part of the honors program, and I was a Sullivan, and there were six other scholars chosen each year at that time. And so, in fact, the person who gave me the award last night was my Sullivan brother, DJ Widener, who is now on the Board of Governors for Seattle University. And while I was here, I studied sociology and international studies. And then after... Actually, during my senior year, a young guy named Barack Obama decided to run for president, and I had read The Audacity of Hope, his autobiography, and was just really moved by his story, and as a biracial young man trying to kind of figure out his identity and figure out his place in the world, it really spoke to me as a transracial adoptee. My mother's white, my family's white, and I felt like somebody really kind of understood me and I really understood him. So I just jumped on his campaign, didn't think that we were going to win, and then we did, and we went to the White House. And I decided to apply for the White House internship in the summer of 2009. And actually, it was recommended by a fellow Seattle U alum, Allison Palmer, who was a year older than me in the Sullivan class. And she said, I thought you would be great for this. And so I decided to go ahead and apply. And I ended up at the White House in 2009. And was there until the end of 2011, when I went on the 2012 campaign. And while I was at the White House, I was in the Office of Public Engagement, and I also worked for the President's senior advisor, Valerie Jarrett, and she oversaw the Office of Public Engagement, Intergovernmental Affairs, Urban Affairs, the Council on Women and Girls. She was basically the President's kind of best friend and chief advisor, and I learned a lot from her, and we had an office in the West Wing, so I sat in the West Wing, yeah. We used to joke that we were above the president because we were on the second floor and he was on the first floor. So I was there, and then I went to Chicago for the 2012 campaign, and I was the briefings manager, which meant that all of the paper that went from the campaign to the White House, I had to edit and track and make sure that they had all the information they needed for every political event or phone call or meeting that they were going to do, and that was for the president, the first lady, the vice president, and Dr. Biden. And after that, I was sort of burnt out on politics a little bit, and I went to graduate school. And so I went to Princeton, and I got a master's in public affairs. And I studied, sort of focused on international development as well as management. And while I was in graduate school, I decided to be a fellow for the Malala Fund. And that was where I met another Nobel Peace Prize winner, Malala Yousafzai. And I was employee number 5. They were just building up the fund. She had this was in 2014, and she had been shot in 2012, and her book had come out in 2013, and so they were just trying to channel that sort of energy and attention and money into girls' education around the world. And so I spent the summer working with her and working for the family and helped them on their first big tour in the U.S., and then that fall, I went back to graduate school, but she won the Nobel Peace Prize. And So they asked me to travel with the family to the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in Oslo and help staff the family while they were there, which was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. And I finished graduate school and decided that I was going to sort of try. Was at that time, Ferguson was sort of raging in St. Louis, and there was a lot of work around racial justice, and so I wanted to work on that, and so I sort of stayed in New York and was a COO for a company that was focusing on sort of creative social impact, so how to get artists involved with amplifying this type of work. And then in 2016, I decided that I was going to hop on a presidential campaign one last time, and I jumped on Bernie Sanders' campaign, another long shot bid, and traveled with him for the entire primary season, saw him all the way through to the DNC, and that was an incredible experience. And then in the last year, I have been working for another Nobel Peace Prize winner, my third, Kailash Satyarthi, who won the Nobel with Malala in 2014. And I work for his foundation, and our focus is on ending child labor and child trafficking. So, brings me up to today. I'm still doing that now.
Wow. A whole lot to cover. Wow. I mean, that's just so amazing. How do you think SU kind of prepared you for all those different experiences? Do you feel like you came out prepared, or was there a huge learning curve?
Yes, I mean, you know, so often I go back to the lessons and the values that were really instilled in me here at Seattle University. I think Seattle U really taught me the value of community and really building relationships as a foundation to really support one another in doing this kind of work. You can't do it alone. And so everywhere I've gone, I've really tried to build that type of community, and I think that's why I've been able to be successful. And I've seen in these incredible leaders, they do the same thing. And part of why I think I've been able to work with them is that I understand what it means to be a part of a community that is supporting a larger mission and a larger cause. And that is just, it's just in the sort of bloodstream of Seattle U. I just feel like everywhere you go, it's sort of in the ether. It's everywhere that you talk about those values, you talk about global awareness, you talk about the education of the whole person.
Yes, there we go.
Yes, almost there. Yes, the whole person. You know, I think that still, I come back to that all of the time. I come back to the feeling that I had when I was at Seattle U, of really feeling called to do work that is meaningful, making sure that every day it's bigger than you, you know, that you really are putting in that effort. Every day is an opportunity, and that really comes from the grounding and the teachings I got here at Seattle U.
Mm-hmm. So did you always know you wanted to work in social justice and these bigger causes, or was there a particular cause you got started in that made you think, wow, this is what I need to be doing?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. My first year or two, really, at Seattle U, I was really shy. I was really quiet. I didn't know. I was overwhelmed because I had come from a small town. I grew up in a really small town in Oregon. It was like 15,000 people, and so when I came to Seattle U and I was in the honors program, I was surrounded by all these other brilliant people, and for the first time, I was just sort of felt really overwhelmed by the fact that I was kind of like stuck in the middle a little bit, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I didn't really know where I fit in. I was didn't speak up in class very often, and it was between my sophomore and junior year that I did a program called the Oxfam America's Change Program, and it was a week-long summer program where it was about teaching college students how to kind of be activists and how to work on different social justice causes. And for the first time, I found something that really spoke to me. I was like looking for something that I really wanted to take on, and the focus was fair trade. And being in Seattle, I decided to work on fair trade coffee. And that became kind of my passion. We started the Oxfam Club at Seattle U, and I believe that it went on for another almost 10 years. I think the club went on. And, you know, I started with my friends as a part of the club, and then it grew. And by the time I left, we had a list of 500 people who would participate in different activities. And that really kind of got me to sort of the sense of the power of community, the power of building, the power of having a cause, being able to use your voice for that, bringing in other people to have who have other ideas, creative ideas that you wouldn't have on your own. And I just wanted, I think in some ways I've sort of been chasing that feeling probably my entire career. It's like I just want to get back to that feeling of what it was like to stand in the quad and, you know, give a speech to a bunch of people about, you know, let's buy fair trade coffee. And you know, so I sort of have just kind of fumbled my way through, and I've tried to just remain open to opportunity and to, you know, never see anything as a closed door, but always see it as, you know, you got to knock a little bit harder sometimes to push through, and then just be open and saying yes to things that maybe initially other people might tell you, I don't know if that's the best idea. I don't know, you know, that seems like that's kind of impossible. Why would you even try that? I'm like, yes, let's try it. And so I think that's kind of what's really driven, you know, my wanting to do this kind of work.
Wow. So you've talked a lot about kind of fostering community and how it's so important. What are ways that you do that in different positions? How are those communities different in each role that you take on?
It's a great question. I've been doing local political work lately. I've moved back to the Seattle area at the end of 2015, and it was the first time that I was like kind of back in Seattle after being at Seattle U, because I kind of left and gone off to Washington, D.C. and all of that and the East Coast. And so when I came back, I was just like, I just want to be helpful. You know, it was right after the, it was over the course of the 2016 campaign, and then, you know, when the election happened, people were like looking, people were scared, and people were looking for something to do, some way to feel, I think, kind of feel like they had some power in a situation that felt really chaotic. And so I just tried to bring together people that seemingly were on different sides. I've always tried to find ways to reconcile differences, to respect and value that people come from different backgrounds, different perspectives. That's not a bad thing. That's not scary. That it's actually really valuable to be able to surround yourself with different types of people. I've just taken on a larger political role with the King County Democrats, and you know, there's been a lot of fractures because there's been a sort of a lot of infighting and whatnot. And what I'm finding is I'm employing a bit of President Lincoln, President Obama style of team of rivals, and it's not easy, but it's really valuable to be able to bring different people to the table and try to understand and try to get to the best compromise, the best solution by being able to hear all those different perspectives. So I actively try to do that, especially in political work, because so often people fall on these different sides and are really entrenched, really passionate about it. And so I try to just make room to listen and make sure that you're valuing that feedback that you're getting and seeing that as a gift, not something that you're trying to be defensive or fight about your point, but really trying to find where's the common ground. And then personally, I mean, I was speaking to a group of eighth graders a couple weeks ago, and and this young girl came up and she said, you know, what's the thing? Same thing I just did with you all, which is I talked through my career and said that I've met these various people and I've done this type of work. And she said, well, what are you most proud of? And I said, you know, actually what it is that I have an incredible group of friends around the world. I have friends in almost every major city. I have people who really, really care about me. And that's because I've really built that. I've taken the time to be there for them. They're there for me. I seek those folks out. I try to do whatever I can to listen and learn and make space for them. And that is something that I'm incredibly proud of. And I learned that at Seattle U. In the Sullivan community, we used to have to get together every other week. We'd all meet as a group and we would all go around and we would have to say sort of our highs and our lows, or like what we were grappling with. And there's something really powerful about being present to other people's experiences. And I carry that with me, and it means so much to be able to know that you can create that wherever you go, and you can also pick up a phone and someone, you know, that someone will be on the other line who genuinely cares, and you have to put the time into that.
You seem to keep coming back and forth on politics throughout your career. You know, you've like gone to politics, come back out. Do you think that's one of the best ways to incite social change? Did you always think that you would be so entrenched in politics in your career?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do go in and out. It's one of those where it's like, I keep trying to leave and they keep pulling me back in. you know, I don't know what it is. Since I was a kid, I have been I've been interested in politics. I was the kid that, you know, on the playground was, you know, trying to convince people to vote for, you know, Bill Clinton or gosh, who was it before Bill Clinton? You know, like, I was always trying to make some sort of impassioned plea as to why, you know, this was going to be the right side of history and this was going to be the right thing to do. And I, you know, I was being reminded that I was a preschool teacher who was a Republican who I would argue with on the regular at 4 and 5 years old. She reminded me that just not that long ago. And, you know, so I think there's something there. I think, you know, my grandmother was British, and so she had to earn her citizenship. She had to go take a test. She had to study for that test. She had to be interviewed for that, and she gained her citizenship when she was in her, I believe she was in her early 50s, late 40s, when she finally got her citizenship. And so it was a big deal. At the dinner tables growing up, we always talked about current affairs. We talked politics. I remember being taken to the polls when I was a small child, and that was something that the family was very proud of. And so there's a part of me that I think really holds on to that as something that feels right, and does feel like a way to channel trying to make a change in the world for the better. I've now been in politics enough to know that it is not always the best way that you can make change, which is why I think sometimes I do like to take the break to try to see what it, you know, try to do the work from the outside. I think that there's value in being on the inside, and I think there's value in being on the outside. When you're on the inside, you have the ability and the resources and the viewpoint to be able to sometimes make some really key institutional changes that you can't make when you're on the outside, because you don't know the players don't know you in the same way, and so you have to make sort of incremental changes that can lead to really huge impact. You can do that from the inside better than you can do it from the outside. When you're on the outside, you can hold people's feet to the fire in a way that when you're on the inside, you just can't. And there's a way to push, there's a way to, I mean, you see it now in the way that protests, I think, have really become, people are back out in the streets, really standing up for their rights, standing up for what they value, what they believe in. And that's powerful. That forces attention in a way that doing the sort of day-to-day work internally, you're not always able to do. So I think that it's important to be able to do both. I had a mentor at Princeton say once that she thought it was really important to have experience in the public sector, in the private sector, and in sort of the foundation NGO sector, so that you could see kind of a 360 view of how to make change happen. And there's a language that each of those sectors speak that it's important to be able to understand so that you can craft your language for the audience you're trying to reach. So, you know, I think more and more the private sector is influencing government. And so it's important to be able to understand how those folks think. Because if you don't speak that same language, you're never going to be able to get them to do what you need them to do. So I think it's important to be able to move, you know. And I think more and more, you know, being able to be adaptable in that way is important. But yeah, I mean, I keep trying to leave, but here I am, you know.
Is there one of those that you enjoy working with the most? Is it politics or the NGOs or, you know, working in those other places? Like, what kind of fits best for you? Or is it all three? Is that culmination of knowing all that information?
Yeah. I think I've definitely realized that I am, at the end of the day, I'm very mission-driven. You know, I've realized that people are driven by different things, and it's okay. And, you know, I mean, some people are driven by a desire to be able to turn profit, you know, because profit allows them to be able to make decisions or have influence in a certain way. Some people are really driven by, you know, a desire to get to have time, you know, balance, and some folks, like myself, I think are really mission and cause driven, and so I find that I'm drawn to organizations, to projects, to endeavors that are really about a particular sort of cause that is meaningful to me. And those causes are, they change. And, you know, right now the work that I'm doing with the Kailash Satyarthi Children's Foundation, it's about child labor and child trafficking. I never would have thought that that would be something that I'd be really passionate about, but as I've learned about it and I've been really inspired by Kailash himself, it's become something that I really feel like I want to take on. You know, Kailash talks about there's, you know, in a generation he thinks we can end child labor and child trafficking. And, you know, there are 152 million child laborers and kids who are being trafficked. 152 million. And to think about, you know, maybe by getting to do this work, just for a little while, maybe we can make a dent in that. I feel called. That helps me get up in the morning. The political work, I feel like right now in the United States, it's really important that we stay engaged. I think especially as a young woman of color, I'm a, you know, an older millennial, but I'm still a millennial. I think it's really important. I think it's important that we don't abandon the system, because part of why we're in the mess that we're in is because so many people didn't vote and so many people felt like it was so broken that they kind of walked away. And so I stay engaged because it's important to me and because I want to do that for myself, but also as a model to other people, to other young people, to other women, to people of color, that our voices need to be heard and we need to be at the table. So that's like, that's what kind of keeps me going. And those causes change, and sometimes it's multiple things at once, and sometimes I'm really passionate about one thing at a time, but it's sort of the, like, what makes you want to get out of bed in the morning. And I think about that when I think about what I'm going to take on.
As someone who works in politics and seeing kind of the upsurgence of people protesting and things like that and taking up these causes and becoming more engaged, you know, how does that make you feel? Does it give you hope for politics and what's going to happen? Do you feel like voices are going to become heard that haven't historically been heard in the past?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's actually a lot of hope to be found in a time that can often feel quite chaotic and dark, because of exactly as you described it, which is that people are not giving up. You know, I mean, I remember the refrain around as we were heading into election day for 2016. It was like, well, we're all just going to move to Canada if it doesn't go our way. And that hasn't happened. There hasn't been a mass exodus to Canada. I'm sure there's a few. But, you know, I think most of us, we're in Seattle. It's a pretty easy drive. But here we are. And I think that there is, there are people who are saying, like, no, not on my watch. And you know what? I'm going to stand up for my rights. I'm going to stand up for the rights of others. I'm going to stand with other people. You know, the Muslim travel ban last year. And, you know, people, I mean, I went to the airport. And I mean, just seeing hundreds of people go to the airport, you know, like on a moment's notice to say, we're not going to let this happen. We're not going to let them take our brothers and sisters. And so that gives me a lot of hope, and the campaign I work on is geared to youth. It's geared to people between the ages of 13 to 25. And what I'm seeing is a generation that is, like, completely, they're better connected than ever before. They are doing the work. They care. They want to be connected to work that matters. And that tells me that, like, the world's going to change for the better. Like, if we stick with them, we're going to be okay. It's when we let it go to the folks who don't have much to lose because they don't have as much time left. And because, you know, they're controlling everything. So, you know, that's why I'm like, listen to the young people. They'll lead the way. Like, really, truly, I really do believe that. But we have to stay with it. You can't just give it up because you're then letting other people decide for you, and they will not decide in your best interest. You have to be a part of it.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the campaign you're working on now with 100 million children? Because you've brought that up a few times.
Yeah, sure. Yes, so specifically under the Kailash Satyarthi Foundation, I work for the 100 million campaign. And the idea is that it is aiming to be the largest youth-led mobilization in history, with the goal of ending child labor and child trafficking, and to create a world that is child-friendly, where every child can be free, safe, and educated. And Kailash has spent the last, like, 40 years basically dedicating his life to children's rights, and he's rescued some, like, 87,000 children over the course of his lifetime. And, you know, what I was so moved by, so I met Kailash at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony when I was there with Malala. And I was, you know, in the room, and I didn't know much about Kailash. I hadn't heard about him, and I'm, you know, in Oslo's City Hall, you know, at the presentation, and they put up a film about Kailash, and they show this guy who looks like an Indian Abraham Lincoln. He's very tall, and busting down doors and rescuing children from these awful situations where they are toiling away for hours and hours and hours. And I was so deeply moved, and as a child from India, adopted from India, it was really personal because I kept thinking, that could have been me. Like, that could have been my life. And this work, what I'm seeing is, it's actually his model of rescuing these children, creating an environment where they get to learn, they get to play, they get to be fed well, they get to be children. It's changing people's lives, and it's also making the world a better place. Like, really, truly, he's making an indent. So that's what the work is about. We are looking to create campus groups across the world, but I'm the U.S. campaign manager, so my focus is really on building the campaign here in the United States. I'm hoping that we have a campus group here at Seattle U very shortly. Anyone's interested, reach out. We also have a film that's coming out about Kailash's work and about child labor and child trafficking that won the best U.S. documentary at Sundance in January and will be released in the fall. And we're hoping to have the world's largest premiere at campuses across the world. So we're really hoping that we get some young people to join up. You can go to the website. It's 100million.org to learn more. Thank you.
Forget my question now. I was just so interested in that. Do you think that your work with the Malala Fund obviously kind of fueled your interest into that? Like, is that kind of how you branched in there with meeting him and whatnot?
Yes, definitely. I mean, my time with Malala was really special. I've learned a great deal from just getting to be in her presence. She is one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met. When I was working with her, she was 16, and, you know, for all intents and purposes, like, should have died. She was shot point blank on her school bus, you know, and the shooters were very, you know, probably within a few feet of her, and shot her in the head. And she's had ongoing, you know, like, physical therapy and whatnot, and has hearing loss in one of her ears because of that, but really, truly should have died. And one of the big lessons I learned from her is that when you face your fears, and if one of your fears is death, and you actually have, like, where you should have died, but you live, when you face your fears, you get to be fearless. And she embodied that. She could walk into a room with anyone. I mean, with President Obama, with the President of Nigeria, with Secretary General of the UN. And she had no problem saying, you know, it's not okay what you are doing. You are not doing enough. She met with President Obama, and she said, stop dropping drones on my people. And, you know, when I was with her when Boko Haram had kidnapped hundreds of girls in Nigeria. And so she went to Nigeria, and she met with the president, and she said, you are not doing enough. I know you can do better. You need to save these girls. And he had not been moving on anything, but his meeting with her made him actually invest in trying to fight Boko Haram and trying to find these girls. And, you know, I was almost twice her age when I was working with her. And, you know, we'd walk into these rooms and, like, I'd be nervous, and no one cared what I had to say. I was, like, just sassing her, but I'd be nervous. And she, no fear. And that, it really changed the way that I try to approach difficult situations. I try to approach my days. And that work lended itself to then, you know, learning about Kailash. But it was a really beautiful time with Malala. And, you know, the focus on girls was, you know, definitely meaningful. And, yeah, just very grateful for that time with her.
So I think kind of bringing it back to SU and your experiences here, if you could go back, is there anything that you would change about your experience at SU? Are there things you feel like you missed out on, things you think you should have done more of, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to not look at life as in terms of regrets. I tend to look at them as opportunities to learn. But yes, I mean, I definitely, the first couple of years, I was I was always nervous. I was very anxious while I was here. I was always nervous about fitting in. I was nervous about doing the right thing or saying the right thing or seeming like I was asking a stupid question in a class, or, you know, that I was going to screw up on an exam or a paper. I was always nervous. And it meant that I didn't get to enjoy the experience of being on a campus, of being around. You know, college is such a special time because you get to live near your best friends, you know? You get to live in the basically around the same place. You get to be completely invested in learning and in yourself. You get to be investing in your own brain, in your own identity, and you get to do it with your friends. And that, as I've, you know, gone on and traveled a lot, I miss that. You know, my friends are spread out all over. I've lived in D.C. when my friends have lived in Seattle. I've lived in Seattle when my friends are in D.C. And, you know, and so I just think that that is something that I wish I had really appreciated more. And instead of, you know, refusing to go hang out with my friends on a Friday night because I wanted to study more, I wanted to write that perfect paper, I wish I had gone and spent more time. And I wish that I had been more okay with myself, you know, given myself more space to breathe, to enjoy life, to enjoy the people here, to learn the things that I really wanted to learn and just enjoy it and really take the time to enjoy it. I think that's really important. And also that it's okay to not know things. It's okay to I changed my major. I didn't decide my major until the end of my sophomore year.
Wow.
Yeah, and I came in thinking I was going to go into journalism, actually, because I, at the time, Michael Moore had just put out, like, I think it was Fahrenheit 9/11, and I really wanted to do sort of expose type of journalism, and, you know, and then it was different classes I took, and I met Dr. Jody O'Brien. I took a class with her my second semester of my sophomore year, and it was in that class that she got to know me and took an interest in me, and I was like, oh, sociology is a great fit for me. I get to study race and gender and class and social dynamics. That's my life. That's who I, you know. And I didn't know, right? I had no idea that that was even really an option. And so I'd say just be open. Be open to change. Be open to learning. Be open to being okay with not knowing. And trusting, this is the biggest thing I think I've learned in the last 10 years or so of my career, which is to, like, to trust the process, to trust that even if it's hard in the moment, you're working through things, and that it'll work out the way that it needs to work. If you stay engaged, if you are actively staying engaged in your own life, you know, not just letting things happen passively, but you are trying to do good work, you're trying to learn, you're trying to connect with people, Life will give you opportunities for it to work out. And you just kind of have to trust that and be okay that there will be days when it's really confusing and hard and scary and sad sometimes. But then the sun will come out. You know, the sun will come out. And we know this in Seattle. There'll be great, a lot of gray days. And then the sun will come out and it'll be beautiful. And so you kind of have to just trust that and try not to allow yourself to get stuck in any one place, whether that is in the dark places or the sunny, happy places, because those are fleeting too. So just trying to leave room for that and really try to enjoy that experience, I think, is really important. And I didn't do that as much as I would have liked at Seattle. And then one last thing is that I would say I didn't study abroad because I was so afraid of missing time at Seattle U, and I regret that. And I think that everyone should try to find time to go abroad in some shape or form. Seattle U has a lot of programs where they have financial support for that, and that's different than a lot of other colleges. And so I would say absolutely do that and invest in learning another language. That's something that I took Spanish, but I didn't perfect it, and I didn't travel with it, and so it's something that I do regret.
Just finished Spanish, and it's not very good. Yeah. I'm regretting it.
Yeah, go to a Spanish-speaking country, and you will get better, and you'll have to actually really learn it. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Are there any other last words of parting wisdom that you'd like to give?
No, thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been a pleasure to have this conversation with you.
And
I just hope that, you know, that any of the students or young people out there that are listening, that they really do find that ability to face those fears so they too can become fearless and to embrace the opportunities and really look for the ways to enjoy the time at Seattle U, because it's a really special place.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.